This is the podcast for Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. So today we're going to do Hume, David Hume, his essay of miracles. Actually, this is a section of one of his books that's often taken as a separate, used as a separate essay. This is from his inquiry concerning human understanding. And so he is arguing against miracles. And he starts out with this discussion of the doctrine of the real presence. Anybody know what the doctrine of the real presence is? It's a...
transubstantiation.
Sometimes there's a... people talk about transubstantiation and consubstantiation. And this is the idea that the host and the wine in the communion service.
Literally turns into the blood.
Yeah.
And body.
Become the literal...
your body and blood.
Blood and body of Jesus. And Hume has uses this as his point of departure for his essay. So remember, Hume's an empiricist, and so he has good things to say about this theologian, Dr. Tillotson, Dr. Tillotson has an argument against this, and he has this argument which has to say with it that the evidence of the senses are more certain than the evidence of testimony. Evidence of the senses is more certain than the evidence of testimony. So, and the argument is something along the lines that even if the Bible reported that the host became Jesus' body and blood, or the host and wine. And the host is just a bread, unleavened bread. So when Jesus is with his disciple, what's called the Last Supper, it's the last evening Jesus spends with his disciples, it's a Passover meal. He says, "This is my body broken for you. This is my blood, the blood of the new covenant, shed for you." And he says, "Do this in the remembrance of me." And he tells them to eat his body and drink his blood until he comes again. And so Catholics take this as a literal meaning, and they think that under the guise of bread and wine, you're eating the real body of Jesus and drinking the real blood of Jesus, and it only has the appearance of bread and wine. And they use some Aristotle's metaphysics, and they say, well, the form is bread and wine, but the substance is Jesus. So there's an argument against this, and Dr. Tillotson says, look, what is the Bible? The Bible is secondhand accounts of what people saw. So you have evidence from the senses, the things you see directly with your own eyes and hear with your own ears, and then there's secondhand reporting. So which is more certain? So suppose you overhear your friend make a racist remark. Okay, and then later on, a friend of your friend says, I've known Bill for 10 years, and I've never heard him make a racist remark, and he's like a completely unracist person. And I have 10 years of observations of Bill, and Bill has never said anything remotely racist. As a matter of fact, he has no tolerance for racism. Well, what are you going to believe, right? You hear the guy make like just the most virulent racist remark you've ever heard. Not just sort of an off-color joke, not just like a little remark, but just something that's just like, you know, it's just like a horribly racist remark. You think, well, you believe your own senses, right? Because you heard him say it. And it's not like you like sort of heard somebody across the hall and you thought it might have been him that said it. It's like you're walking by, you see his lips moving, and he goes, you know, and says, and makes this racist remark. So you're not going to go with secondhand testimony. You're going to go with what you heard yourself. So he says in the same way, what are you going to believe? It's kind of maybe another illustration of this. There's this movie with from the 60s called The Diary of an Unmarried Woman. No, Guide for the Married Man. Guide for the Married Man with Walter Matthau. And he's talking about what to do when your wife catches you cheating. And his answer is deny, deny, deny. And so in the scenario, as he's giving advice to a younger man about, you know, how to survive married life, he says, suppose your wife comes home and catches you in bed with another woman, and they, you know, snap to the scene. And so you see, you know, Walter Matthau's in bed with his other woman, and the wife walks in, and she's like, like that, and she starts, like, you know, she's in shock, and she's like yelling, and then as she's ranting and raving, the woman's putting on her clothes, and pretty soon she's out the door. Walter Matthau's like making the bed, and then after a moment, he says, what woman? And then she like looks around, and the bed's made, the woman's nowhere to be seen, and it's like, you know, he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like sitting in his easy chair by this time, smoking a pipe and reading a book. Right? So, and there's this old saw, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes, right? So, but that's funny because, you know, you believe the evidence of your senses before you believe somebody else's say-so. And so the idea of this is just, even if the Bible supported transubstantiation, which it doesn't, you know, argues Dr. Tillotson, it still wouldn't be evidence that transubstantiation is real because it goes contrary to your senses. Because when you're eating that bread, it looks like bread, it tastes like bread, and, you know, your senses tell you it's bread. So the idea that you're eating the body of a first century Palestinian Jew is absurd. So that's essentially his departure. And this is a theme. He puts up this general principle that testimony is always one step removed from the evidence of the senses, and that you need to testimony to senses, let's see. Evidence of senses is more certain than the evidence of testimony. Because testimony is just other people using their senses and then transmitting that information to you. But it's always secondhand. And firsthand information is always better than secondhand information. Seeing with your own eyes, hearing with your own ears, is always better than hearing somebody else telling you what they saw with their own eyes or what they heard with their own ears. That's Hume's general principle that he starts out with. And then he proceeds to develop this. Then he talks about, well, concerning matters of fact, your senses aren't super reliable. So, but you can kind of see that certain things, they happen with certain effects proceed for certain causes all the time, and some of them just some of the time. So he draws a contrast between the weathers. He says, though experience be our only guide in reasoning concerning matters of fact. So by experience, he's talking about sense experience. So if you're trying to, and this goes back to our earlier discussion of Hume, right? How do you know whether something's true in mathematics or geometry or talking about like a logical problem? Well, that's a priori reasoning. How do you know that things are true about the world a matter of fact, well, you have to use your senses. And you can't use reasoning to prove a matter of fact. You can't think about a concept and prove that something exists or something is true that's a fact about the world. To know whether Barack Obama is president of the United States, I can't just meditate on the concept of Barack Obama and the concept of president and see whether the two go together or not. Whereas if I want to know whether 2 and 2 is 4, I just peer inside my own mind and see that it's true. If I want to know whether George Washington really had wooden teeth, I gotta do some investigation using my senses, and I'll have to go with like some documents which were written by someone who saw Mr. Washington with some wooden teeth, and maybe an account by his dentist or other people who saw the teeth, or maybe in a museum someplace I might find a set of teeth which are said to have been George Washington's false teeth, and then I have to do some investigation to see whether they really are or not. So, but you're still talking about using your senses.
But that's still secondhand testimony.
Right, that's true. But it's all based on sensory information. So sensory information can either come from you directly or it can come from other people. And so all he's saying is that when it comes to matters of fact, you have to rely on experience. Not a priori reasoning, but a posteriori reasoning. Evidence of the senses, either direct or indirect. And then he talks about generally you think there's going to be better weather in June than in December. And generally it's true. But he says sometimes there's a day in June which is so cold and miserable, it's worse than a day in December which might be a pretty nice sunny day. Every once in a while you get a fluke. You can't really predict the weather with certainty. Now, generally speaking, June's going to be warm and December's going to be cold. June's going to be dry and December's going to be wet. But there might be a time when in June you get a really cold day and a wet day, and in December you get a sunny and a dry day. And so he says you need to proportion your belief in accordance with the evidence. And when you're thinking about how much confidence you should put in the weather, you should have some reservations and realize that the weather prediction isn't an exact science, and that sometimes you get a day which is not part of the usual course of events of what you expect from those other days. So he says on page 205, a wise man therefore proportions his belief to the evidence. So now he wants to apply these to apply this to this the eyewitness testimony, trying to figure out, well, is eyewitness testimony the sort of thing that's reliable? He makes a couple observations that it's on this is paragraph 88, page 205. We're not as near the bottom. We're not the memory tenacious to a certain degree. Had not men commonly an inclination to truth and a principle of probity? A lot of fancy jargon here. Were they not sensible to shame when detected in a falsehood? Were not these, I say, discoverable by experience to be qualities inherent in human nature, we should never repose the least confidence in human testimony. A man delirious or noted for falsehood or villainy had no manner of authority with us. So he's talking about the fact that, generally speaking, you give some credence to testimony. Why? Because most of the time, people remember things okay, and not everyone is a liar, and not everyone is given to flights of fancy. But then he says, but if you think about in general, we do recognize that there are people who mislead others, and sometimes they do it knowingly and sometimes they do it unknowingly. And so sometimes you have people who, well, they just talk about this. What are some reasons for people to, what might be a reason why someone would report something that didn't actually happen?
So reasons
why eyewitness testimony could be false.
Notoriety?
Notoriety. So someone want...
Or fame?
Yeah, a person... is seeking fame. So if a one-armed Swiss farmer with a broken camera begins making claims that he's being visited by aliens and he purchases photographs of Italian supermodels and obviously doctor pictures of spaceships and even dinosaurs, you might be a little bit skeptical. Billy Meyer is a good example, I think, of someone who's looking for publicity. Do you think of any other...
when somebody has, like, an investment in people believing they're wrong, the falsehood. So, for example, a corporation selling a toxic chemical, might that be too interested in telling people it's toxic?
Uh-huh. So, seeking fame and punished, but perpetrating a hoax, just to be clear here. So you get a lot of people that we can go on to the thing about people not having a vested interest. But here's a particular kind of vested interest in perpetrating the people that perpetrate hoaxes for notoriety. So you have like churches that have weeping statues. And once you have a weeping statue and people find out about it, they flock to your church. And then you have like a little, you know, donation tray at the door, and pretty soon you're getting, you know, hundreds of dollars every day. Well, you know, that you think that's pretty good. There might be the idea that people sincerely believe in it. But there are obvious cases of people that hoax things for money. To sell books. I'll just put this to sell books for
personal gain, right?
And I'd be make money. I suppose fame is, I'll just leave fame alone here. Let me just, you think about this idea. Fame might be an end in itself. Maybe the person really doesn't want money.
Could attention be a better word for fame?
Yeah, attention, I like that. Yeah, people. Yeah, human beings are social creatures, and particularly if you get a person that people don't pay attention to, and they start telling these crazy, extravagant stories, and pretty soon people start listening to them, that might be a sufficient motivation. So, fame, money, what else? Power.
What
about
shifting the blame?
Yeah,
like protecting
your reputation. To shift blame to others. Right, so this sort of idea of toxic chemicals or something like that. Someone's trying to cigarette companies, they don't want you to know that smoking gives you cancer, right? And so they're trying to like muddy the science and make people think that there isn't good scientific evidence that you get lung cancer. That it's sort of it might not be great for you, but it's not going to kill you, right? And that the evidence is exaggerated, right? So what else? So we have does that fit in with your toxic chemical example here? Because the person has a vested interest, I suppose. Financial interest. Well, I mean, these are sort of basic human motivations, right?
What about the girl who poured acid in her face to get...
Oh, yeah, attention. I think it might fit with the attention. That's a great example, actually. So, there's this woman... you want to tell the story? Do you remember the details?
I think she saw that on the news when that other girl was attacked, so... So, she put acid on her own face to get burned to act like she was attacked.
That's crazy.
She claimed, what was it she said, that a African-American woman with her hair back in a ponytail and an earring or something came up to her. It was like a police sketch and everything. Came up to her with like a styrofoam cup and said something like, hey, little girl, want some of this or something. And like put the ass in her face. And they figure out later that like the angle that she got hit with could have been, it had to have been that... That she did it herself, and they basically grilled her in her hospital bed, and she admitted that she did this herself. And it's even interesting that, speaking about miracles, she credited God with saving her eyes, because she said that even though it was a cloudy day, she lost her sunglasses or something, and had just decided to go into the store and buy some new sunglasses. And if she hadn't been wearing those sunglasses, that her eyes would have been burned. So it's in, you know, praise Jesus, you know, and the sort of was sharing her religious story when this is all something she did. And my question might be, well, if, you know, Jesus saved your eyes, why didn't he save your face? That'd be my question. But that's a separate thing, because it turns out she did it all herself. Why? Because she wanted to sort of have this high profile as a victim, as a martyr, and had some psychological problems and wanted people to pay attention to her because she wasn't feeling very appreciated. And one way to get sympathy from people is by making yourself into a victim. Because there's psychological syndromes. There's one called Munchausen's syndrome. You heard about that, where a person will either feign sickness or make themselves sick to get sympathy from other people. And then there's Munchausen's by proxy, where you'll actually get parents who will poison their children with arsenic, with toxic substances of all kinds, with rat poison in their food. And then the kid gets really sick, and they're like, they have intestinal hemorrhage and just this horrible, horrible sickness, and they get weak. And then everybody says, oh, your poor kid, you know, and so the parent has someone to take care of all day, and all the relatives and everyone says, oh, you know, that's, you know, be strong, you know, you'll be able to get through this, you're poor, poor child. So, and it's just like a crazy, you know.
There's been enough cases of that to where they made a diagnosis of it, yeah, and a name for it. That's crazy.
Yeah, so this is called, and there's a case in the Sixth, and if you ever seen The Sixth Sense, I'm going to give a spoiler. It's been out for a long time. So The Sixth Sense or something about that. It turns out that's why this kid is sick. It's that mom's been poisoning her.
What?
So we'll put like maybe psychosis. Or even hallucinations. People hearing voices. All right, so it might be the person isn't trying to put one over on you, but they generally believe that the aliens are talking to them, right? Or that they're, you know, that they believe that they're possessed by demons or, you know, whatever it is. What else? Any other reasons why a person might be mistaken in their testimony? Yeah.
Well, maybe they thought they saw something they didn't.
Yeah, so just I think what you're talking about, misinterpretations of sensation. So there's like a lot of cases of like people that think they experience ghosts, for example. It turns out like they hear these weird kind of rattling sounds in the basement, you know, like, oh, you know, the house is haunted. And it turns out there's some like weird thing with the pipes that they're making these sort of rattling noises, or they got rats in the walls, or there's something, or sometimes it'll be sort of you'll hear kind of moaning sounds, and it turns out that the wind's whistling through a crack in the basement door, or the pipes aren't well insulated and they're kind of venting steam or something, and you hear this sort of sounds like, you know, in the middle of the night, like somebody moaning, and it's really, it's just some naturalistic sound. But if a person is given to flights of fancy and they, you know, believe in ghosts, then they're thinking, oh, it must have been a ghost. So now Kim says given all these things, if somebody tells you something, you know, are you going to believe the testimony or not? Under what conditions would you believe testimony? So what does he say about like testimony in general? What is, does he think it's trustworthy, untrustworthy?
He says it varies a lot.
Yeah, so it just depends on the conditions. Now, when it comes to miracles, he says on page 207, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. This is his definition of a miracle. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. And a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws. Excuse me. And as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against the miracle from the very nature of the fact, as is entire from any argument from experience, can possibly be imagined. So, and he says, why is it more probable that all men must die, that lead cannot of itself remain suspended in the air, that fire consumes wood and is extinguished by water, unless it be that these events are found agreeable to the laws of nature, and that there is required a violation of these laws, or in other words, a miracle, to prevent them. Nothing is esteemed a miracle if it ever happened in the common course of nature. It is no miracle that a man in seemingly good health should die on a sudden, because such a kind of death, though more unusual, has been frequently observed to happen. But it is a miracle that a dead man should come to life, because that has never been observed in any age or country. There must therefore be a uniform experience against any miraculous event. Otherwise, the event would not merit that appellation. As uniform experience amounts to a proof, there is here a direct and full proof from the nature of the fact against the existence of any miracle. Nor can any such a proof be destroyed or a miracle rendered credible but by an opposite proof which is superior. Okay. I mean, Hume has a sort of long-winded sentences. But it starts out, he starts out with a simple syllogism. A miracle is a violation of laws of nature. But our uniform experience shows us the laws of nature are never violated. And he makes this distinction between unusual or the improbable, versus the miraculous, the truly miraculous. So he says, unusual events happen, miraculous events no. Now sometimes people will describe events as miraculous, like they'd say, if something really improbable happens, like I'm in a five-car pileup, and although everyone else ends up as a mangled corpse, I end up without a scratch. And I'm like in the middle of the pile. And my car has turned to total piece of rubbish. And it's smashed and bashed, and I've got like one little scrape on my forearm or something like that. And I say, it's a miracle that I survived, right? But really it just means it's kind of an unusual event, because stuff like that doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes it happens that you'll have someone who falls out of a five-story window and maybe he lands on some bushes and bounces off the bushes and lands on some wet grass and he ends up with a couple of bruises and he survives. Most of the time when people fall out of five-story windows, they end up in a serious hurt. Or dead. So he concludes that a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. Our uniform experience shows that the laws of nature are never violated. Therefore, a miracle can never occur.
Where does does the word miracle originate from? Do you know?
No, that's a good question. Etymologically, I think it's an old English word. I'm not sure.
We'll have to deal with that later.
Because when I think of miracles, I think of things that are improbable but not impossible. You know?
Well, there's like this usage in every day, like it'll be a miracle if I can pass this class or whatever. You know, it just means that it's, you know, really you're having a tough time at it, and it would be it's highly improbable, right? But is that really a miracle? You know, in the philosophical sense, a miracle is when someone takes a handful of loaves and fishes and feeds a crowd of 5,000 people. A miracle is when someone is able to walk on water without the help of water skis and a boat to pull them, right? A miracle is when someone was born without a human father. Those are miracles. A miracle is when a person who has been blind from birth and is suddenly able to see.
Seems like every reference you're making is for the figure of Christ.
A miracle, I see, which is some other kind of miracle. I mean, Hume's writing in, you know, Western Europe, when most people are Christians. And you might say, like, a miracle is when a guru is able to materialize an orange out of thin air, if it isn't flight of hand. There's this guy over in India, I can't think of his name.
Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, yeah. Sai Baba, you know, and, you know, ancient coins and pocket watch or whatever. And he's like, you know, nothing on the sleeve, presto, or nothing on my robe, right? Then here's an orange. And like, and if he's doing that in front of your face, you're thinking, wow, that's pretty wild. That's a miracle, because objects just don't pop into existence out of thin air. So those are miracles. Those are violations of laws of nature. Now, what is a law of nature? Well, a law of nature is just a description of stuff that always happens, right? So he talks about lead. You know, lead floated, doesn't float in the air, right? Lead is a heavy object. Heavy objects fall to the ground. So this goes back to human cause and effect, right? If I take this pencil, if I took this pen, and I, like, you know, I have it up here, and I see no wires or anything, it's not all, and I let go of it, and it would just like float in the air here, that would be a miracle, because objects fall to the ground. So that's, yeah.
So would it be fair to say, along this train of thought, then, that like a miracle, like for example, firewalkers, is not necessarily a miracle, it's just that we don't understand the laws of nature that support it?
Yeah, so, and actually we do understand the laws of nature that support firewalkers. What they do is they, one of the things, the firewalkers, if they're walking on an iron grate that was heated to the same degree, or if they put an iron grate over the coals, I guarantee you they would have third-degree burns. What happens is coals are very pithy, and so if you stoke the coals just right and you don't, like, linger on the coals, you're not going to burn your feet, because the coals are very inefficient at distributing heat to other objects. And so one of the reasons you can do that is because the coals are, you know, they're sort of like like a honeycomb, sort of. And so the surface area of the coal to your feet is relatively low, even though the temperature is high. So if you walk real fast, you're not going to get burned. Or you just trip and stick your feet in there.
They usually cruise along there pretty good.
Well, yeah. Have you done the firewalking thing there?
No.
I've seen that. They do it really carefully. Tony Robbins is famous for doing this. It's sort of a, part of it's a metaphor for sort of, you know, overcoming your fears and stuff. But anyway, the coal walking is a good example. Right? You think, well, it's a miracle. Then you find out, well, this is the reason why. It has to do with the physics of heat distribution. You're like, oh, well, maybe that's not a miracle. But, you know, he says, like, for example, fire extinguishes water. So if there was a fire and I poured water in the fire and it kept on burning, or if I took a piece of wood and it was dry and it seemed just normal wood, and I try to light it on fire and it won't light on fire, then that might be a miracle, like the flame. Or if there's a bush that's burning up and not being consumed and starts talking, right? Then that would be a miracle. Because bushes don't talk, and when bushes burn, they tend to be... when you burn something, it's consumed, right? Yeah?
Well,
So these miracles are all on a pretty dramatic scale. What if there were more, just total hypothetically, I'm assuming that these miracles are coming from a God figure, but what if instead of like large dramatic miracles, bushes on fire and fishes and loaves and feeding thousands of people, but what if it was a really, really, really small scale? So like, I'm getting ready to leave my apartment and drive somewhere, and a cockroach happens to jump out of me, slows me down 2 seconds, and because of that, I don't get T-boned on the highway.
Right.
Could that be a miracle?
Hume would say that's one of those improbable events. It was just like really, really lucky.
But what if it's a chain of like 15 of those things that makes whatever chance encounter happen that turns the entire course of your life? You know, I mean, I'm sure you've seen that movie.
Really, really
like
good.
The butterfly effect or something like that.
I mean,
well, it's just luck. I'll give you an example. Let's hear a real little short story about this guy. He's a Nazi German. He's a Jew, and this is before the war, before Hitler comes to power, and he has something really traumatic happen in his family, and that leads him to leave Germany. Because he basically gets brutalized by the Nazis, and this encourages him to leave. And so, had he not been brutalized by the Nazis, he wouldn't have escaped the Holocaust. But he did. And so, there's a sort of question about whether it was a good thing that he was brutalized by the Nazis. Because had he not been victimized in that horrible way when he was young, he wouldn't have been motivated to leave the country before things got really bad, and he got sent off to one of the concentration camps and executed. There's nothing. You might say it was a miracle I survived, because if this hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't have left. But then you think, well, you know, lots of different people were brutalized by the Nazis and left for those reasons too. It's not really a miracle. It's just kind of lucky. Are you thinking about like a chain of events that sort of seem so improbable that something might be so improbable that it's miraculous? Is that the idea?
Yeah.
There's something else is behind it besides just the natural cockroach walking behind it. Maybe something kind of coerced it too, like a bigger picture behind it all.
Yeah. But it had to be a chain of events. It has to be like a series of improbable things.
Too, you know, you can't
like things that
them.
Are so like, oh my God, I can't believe that.
Like, I mean, I've been driving up multiple days, and it's clearly been under freezing, but for whatever reason, the angle that the rain is coming at before there's no ice on the road happens to happen that day, you know? What would he think would be the possibility that instead of miracles, on a grand scale, very, very infrequently, there could be the potential for, like, very, very minuscule miracles
on a
billions
daily basis.
Of times every day?
Yeah. Well, that's just like an improbable event, given that most things happen a certain way all the time. It's like a cold day in June, right? It's just, you know, it doesn't happen. It is really rare, but you know, sometimes it does happen. Tell me, get it.
On the Holocaust thing, there was a story of one of the guys that needed to play the violin or something. He'd never played it in his life, and they shot his partner and said, "Can you play it?" And he says, "Yeah." And he picked it up. Just played like this perfect notes tuned song. He never even picked one up. I would consider that a miracle.
Now, that might be a miracle if you can play something without instruction, although, you know, there are people like that we call, you know, savants, the old non-PC term, idiot savant, right? That are able to perfectly reproduce music. This came out when we were talking about innate ideas.
Right.
He was a savant and he didn't know it.
Right.
Now, he would say that before jumping to the supernatural conclusion, you got to see if there's any natural conclusion. Maybe he had some innate ability he just didn't know, and it happened to be that he had to play the violin and it turned out he was a musical prodigy. Now, that's unusual, but you think about, you think about all the people in the world and who were in a situation where their lives were threatened and they had to do something. You just get two unlikely events to come together, and improbable things have to happen some of the time. Yeah.
So I got a question, like with the feeding of the 5,000, and that was just men, not counting women or children, so there's probably roughly like 20,000 people there, all witnessing a miracle. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
You just like discard that because it was in the past, or I mean, what do you do with that?
That's a good question.
And that didn't happen on just like one occasion. That happened twice, and that wasn't like the only miracles that were witnessed by you know, from Christ. So like there's like probably a large number of people in the Israeli area that witnessed miracles on a daily basis, mm-hmm. over a period of time. I mean, what do you do? Do you just disregard it?
We're still talking about it 2,000 years later.
So you might say like you get errors in transmission.
I can't say two fish
at once. I don't know if you've ever had a thing. Like, they have this thing called you play the telephone game, and you kind of whisper in somebody's ear, and you whisper in somebody else's ear, and eventually it gets around, and you get slowly turned around. Or you don't even have to go that far. Like, I've heard things where people, well, I'll just put it this way, like, I've looked at, like, students' note cards after the exam, and I see the crazy things that sometimes people put on those. Or a student will come to my office, and they'll read what they have in my notes. And I was thinking, how did you get that from what I was saying, right? So even just person to person, I say something, a person listens to it, they write down on a piece of paper, later on we're back in my office, and they got things totally turned around, or garbled and confused. Well, I mean, you'll multiply that by through generations, and maybe you get something where things sort of tend to get magnified, or...
Are you talking the canacity of the Bible?
Well, I just thinking about the events in there before they're written down, that is this written by an eyewitness testimony, eyewitness there, and if so, you know, where it was in the crowd, and we have the say so of this one author that there are these thousands of people there. So, I mean, really, are you dealing with 4,000 or 5,000 witnesses, or are you dealing with one who says there were 4,000 or 5,000?
Okay, well, I mean, then go back further. What about, like, prophetic things? Like, in the book of Daniel, it talks about, like, succession of historical kingdoms that would follow the Babylonian Empire. And it gives, like, specific details. And this is, like, hundreds of years before any of that's going to happen. And then it happens to a T. I mean, are you just going to write that off as well?
That's a good question. So, okay.
Also, prophecy is that it's prophesized and then it's easy to mimic it because it's already been said.
No, it's not easy to mimic it when it's written and historically dated to a period of time that is shown historically to be prior than the events that are followed.
Right.
And see, they happen perfectly.
So, this idea of prophecy. I think the Book of Daniel is a good example. So, some people will say, if you look at the Book of Daniel, it prophesies it was written during the Babylonian Empire. So it talks about the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persians,
and the Greeks,
with Alexander, and the Romans. And some of it's sort of, you know, vague, but a lot of it, you can look at it as particular. It seems to be very particular to these rise of these large empires. So it's not the sort of thing a person would be able to guess at. And it's also, it seems that it's particular enough that it's not something, it's not like reading Nostradamus talking about, you know, his quatrains of it, sort of his metaphors and symbols. It's pretty clear that this is talking about these world empires and the characteristics of each of them and their order and succession. So then the question is, what would you conclude from that? And so one thing you conclude is that it's a miracle that Daniel was given a supernatural vision from God. But what do you think Q would say about this?
Off the drugs.
Well, the drugs wouldn't help you see the future, though, right? Let's assume that the Book of Daniel gives you the broad outline of the rise and fall of the Babylonian, the Persian, Greek, and Roman empires. Maybe it leaves off with the Roman scenes.
Maybe
we'll
follow a natural pattern socially that we're just not aware of, that the one person was.
And he's really good at, you know, knowing the predicting political things. Who would have predicted the last election? Well, I might have. Who would have predicted that Barack Obama, an obscure state senator from Illinois, would be able to get into office because of a sex scandal with a Republican who's married to a movie star who's in Star Trek, because he took her to some swingers club and it got into the papers, and their nasty divorce turned off all the social conservatives. And then, as senator, that he would manage to jump into the White House in two short years.
It
was a miracle.
Since it was like the only one that came true, they just like gave him like the credit.
We talk Daniel?
Yeah, I mean like if like a bunch of people like came up with predictions and then one guy gets it right, you know.
They don't come up with predictions like that because the punishment in Hebrew context, if you were a false prophet, was death. I mean, you don't just like make predictions like hoping for the future, because if one of your prophecies turns out to be false, then you're labeled as a false prophet, and then you kill.
Any other thoughts?
Yeah. Not about that, but like, whose definition of a miracle is that exactly?
What's Hume's definition?
It seems like blank, whatever. If you took a miracle out of there, it's kind of like that is impossible. Violation of the laws of nature. But couldn't you say a miracle is a bigger or like momentous word for an unusual event that touches people in a way they call it a miracle?
Well, this is sort of colloquial use, which is sort of an unusual occurrence. And this is the type of thing that Hume says. I'm not talking about this. Because if you're talking about unusual occurrences, do I dispute that unusual occurrences happen, that people refer to them as miracles? No. Yep. Are there days in January when it might even snow? Sure. Right in Scotland. It might be that there's a few days in Scottish history where you actually had snow in June. I don't know. Or at least it's really cold and windy and rainy in June. Now, don't happen all the time, but once in a blue moon, right? But that's not a miracle. Hume says a miracle is when the laws of nature are violated, like someone who's been dead for 3 days comes back to life.
How do you know he's right in that definition at all? I mean, his cause and effect definition said there's a necessary connection, and then you read Kant, and he says there isn't a necessary connection.
Well, actually, it's the other way around.
Sorry. But I mean, like, you know, it's just a definition. It doesn't mean that it's not. That's just his take on what a miracle actually means. I mean,
well, if a miracle is just an improbable, is someone coming back to life after being dead for 3 days, is that improbable, or is that a violation of the laws of nature?
Violation. Well, I mean, have you ever seen that happen?
Well, I'm just saying, if it did happen, would it be a miracle? And would it be different than it being 80 degrees today instead of whatever it is now, 40?
I mean, people have died and then come back to life. I know that. Like, they've
been after their 3 days. Heart.
Well, maybe not after 3 days, but if you saw that, that means it's possible. But I mean, you see stuff that happens maybe in, you know, minutes and they come back to life. That's still very improbable and a violation of the laws of nature, it seems like. But
suppose I told you I was at my Uncle Leo's wake, because we're Scottish and we have these wakes. And a wake is when you like you hang out by the coffin and like eat hors d'oeuvres around this corpse. Because in the olden days, you didn't know whether they were quite dead or not. You just like hung around because you didn't want to like to dig up the coffin later and see like scratch marks on the top of the casket there, because the guy woke up, right? So you did this. You have this tradition of the wake. Suppose I told you we were at the wake with Uncle Leo and hanging around there, and it was the third day of the wake, you know, we're getting ready to bury him. All of a sudden, like, he sat up in his coffin and said, can I have some hors d'oeuvres, right? Would you believe me?
No, not if I didn't see it.
What if I told you I saw it with my own eyes, and I show you a picture. And I show you a picture, and there's a guy sitting in a coffin with a plate of hors d'oeuvres, and he's, like, eating them. And people around going, they're like, wow. I just like took it like right when they handed that plate of hors d'oeuvres. So that's like empirical evidence, right? Would you be skeptical?
I mean, just because you haven't seen it doesn't mean it's not true. But just because you're telling a story that's really like, you know, extreme in a way doesn't mean. I mean,
now, what do you mean by extreme? I saw with my own eyes.
A miracle on
other
the same
things
life.
That you said, we would probably start to question or look closely at other things that you said, just because of the severe nature of, you know, what you're describing. It doesn't happen that often.
It doesn't happen that often, or that doesn't happen ever.
It doesn't happen ever.
Well, there you go. It's a miracle.
You
know,
but like, he came back alive.
Like, well, that's different. Like, it, you know, yeah, it's like frogs freeze and they come back every year too.
So, you assume that there's like probability that he can live.
Well, I'll say he wasn't frozen though. He was just, you know, he was at room temperature for 3 days and he came back to life. And he wasn't a zombie. Like, the zombies don't exist either. You know? So, was there anybody here that would believe me, though? Yeah.
Are there any other miracles we're talking about besides somebody rising from the dead?
Oh, pick another miracle.
I mean, like, turning wine.
Cloning, say, back in the days before cloning was even possible or thought of. If I told you, I'm going to clone a sheep and it's going to come back exactly the way it was, do you believe me that it's that's possible at all? You'd say probably no and think I'm crazy, just like your story. But now that it's happened, is that considered a miracle because it's possible?
Well, a miracle is something that is a good point. Like, what about things that happen in the future? Thank you.
Well, it might be possible someday that your uncle could rise 3 days from the dead. That doesn't mean anything that it's a
but they didn't
violation.
Have the technology back then,
like Neo and like stop the bullets.
It's a violation of the
They have some kind of state of animation, you know, where they're...
No, I suppose you might say that. You might say, well, maybe he wasn't really dead.
Right.
For 3 days.
Now, why would you say maybe he took some of that voodoo drug like I saw in The Serpent and the Rainbow, and maybe he was like... And actually, there's cases of this where people go into like a deep coma, and they appear to be dead, and they have very shallow respiration and very faint heartbeats, but they're still alive. And then they're like revived. And this is why they used to even have like, they used to put like bells in mausoleums where like if you weren't quite dead yet, you'd like ring the bell for somebody to come because they buried you and interred you by mistake. So you wouldn't like starve to death. But don't you like go back to the explanation thinking, well, he wasn't really dead. I'm telling you a story with some ulterior motive. Why wouldn't you say, oh wow, that's really interesting, I would have liked to have been there? Why wouldn't you believe me? Oh, it's because a miracle is a violation of the law of nature, and you've never seen a dead person come back to life, and so you ought to be skeptical of that. And Hume's saying that there's no amount of evidence that should convince you that this actually happened. My uncle Leo, you know, didn't come back from that.
So then how does he justifiably believe any historical fact?
Well, like, I would say there's a difference between reading that the Trojans fought the Greeks, and believing that Athena. Made Patroclus lose his life through supernaturally guiding a spear into his side or whatever, right? You have a story, or you have a story of a miracle. Like if you read, and somebody give me another example of a miracle.
Red Sea crossing.
The Red Sea is a good thing. How about okay, here we go. Circe. So you have the story of the Trojan War, right, in Homer. And on the way home, Odysseus stops on this island, and there's a sorcerer named Circe who turns his men into swine, right? Now, what Hume would say is that you would be justified in believing, you might be justified in believing the Trojans fought the Greeks, and that the city of Troy was sacked and destroyed, and even that Hector was dragged in a chariot around the city. His corpse was dragged around the city. But you would there would be no amount of evidence to show you that the part of the story about the people being turned into pigs was true. Why? Because you've never seen a person turn into pig, and neither has anybody else. That's a violation of the laws of nature.
So get back to what would Hume say about prophecy? Never really answered that.
I think Hume would say that prophecy is a violation of the laws of nature because people can't know the distant future. And so we know that, that there has to be some explanation. I think Hume would probably say that the book of Daniel must have been written in the 2nd century BC, around the time of the Romans, and then was prophecy after the fact.
And if it's been historically dated prior to that, then what would he say?
He was politically connected, sleeping with the king's daughter.
Well, he would say there's no such...
I mean, would he just continue to deny miracles? Like if there was a miracle right in front of his face, a dead man coming back alive after, I don't know, pick however many days you want to say. I mean, would he just be like, no, not a miracle, just really weird? I mean, it just seems like he's in this like constant state of denial.
I think he'd be looking for the trick. It's just like if you go to see, if you're seeing David Blaine, does the street magic. He's been doing another stunts lately, but he used to do the street magic.
And levitation, one of his tricks is
levitation, right. Yeah. He goes and he like sort of turns around, he puts his arms up, and then he like floats up off the ground like about this high.
People freak out, like it's real good theatrics with the crowd.
So now, who here believes that David Blaine has a metaphysical, like a miraculous power of levitation, right? That he doesn't, you don't think he uses a gizmo or anything? You're just joking, right? but there are people actually, there are gullible people that say, oh, I think he like has mystic powers. The people that come out of the bars.
Well, it was good TV when it was on. It made you go, oh my God, I took a second look at it, but I didn't believe it,
There's actually a funny, I think it's on one of those comedy, college humor.com. There's a funny, if you just Google David Blaine, it'll probably come up. There's a guy doing a spoof on David Blaine. It's pretty funny where he prophesies everything people do in the future. But anyway, so he's the street magician. He levitates. Now, I know that David Blaine doesn't have miraculous powers, and it's a trick. But I don't know how he does it. But I know it's a trick. Why do I know it's a trick? Because there are no such thing as miracles. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. So I know that if he's levitating, he's got some gizmo that he does it, I think. I have a vague idea he has some kind of gizmo that helps him do it. Or maybe it's something they do when they're filming it, that sort of it's doctored in post, and the people that are reacting to him are actors, is another possibility. But I know it's a trick. When David Copperfield makes the Statue of Liberty disappear, I know it's a trick, because things don't disappear. And there is no such thing as magic. Because miracle is a violation of laws of nature, and the laws of nature have no exceptions. Yeah.
So hypothetically, I know Hume isn't a big fan of God. Hypothetically, if God existed, would God be allowed to bend or break the laws he created? Hypothetically.
Yeah, I think so. Sure. God could do a miracle. God's all powerful. If God's omnipotent, of course, he can violate the laws of nature, turn water into wine, part the Red Sea.
So Hume's basic argument is on this idea that there is no all-powerful God.
So he doesn't believe it would take miracles?
It would take something outside of the laws of nature to break the laws of nature.
I think Hume doesn't necessarily say in this argument that there isn't a God. All he says is that, Hume might say if there is a God, he doesn't do any miracles. Yeah.
Could we imply that if miracles were an act of God, that God would have the ability to make miracles happen within the laws of nature?
But if it was within the laws of nature, it wouldn't be a miracle. Because a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature.
What if a miracle is an act of God?
Like existing?
What would you define as an act of God? Like
burning bush.
But that's a miracle. Because the bushes don't talk and bushes are consumed when they're burned.
But if our God being really is God, wouldn't he be able to manufacture it in a way that it would still be fitting the laws of nature and serve his purposes too?
That goes back to being probable event. Like there's some theories about the Red Sea that weather phenomena caused it to the land to dry out, that it drove back the waters and caused this dry land to appear. So, but then it's not a miracle anymore. It's just an improbable occurrence that happened at a fortuitous time. Yeah.
What about things that go against laws of nature, like, say, at a NASA training thing where they're floating around and they're defying gravity? or like a black hole where they say you're sucked backwards in time, or like things like that, you know. But they have like scientific evidence and like theories of how they work, but they're not a violation of nature if it's acting against the laws of like.
But astronauts floating in the Vomit Comet or out in the orbit. They have this plane called the Vomit Comet, and basically it uses the force of gravity to simulate zero G's. So what it does is the plane, like, it goes up and then it dives it with such force and momentum that it counteracts the Earth's gravity, so you get like 60 seconds of where you're kind of floating around in the air. And then, you know, people tend to throw up zero G, hence the name the Vomit Comet, because it goes really fast and makes people throw up. But that's, you know, that operates according to the known laws of nature. Same thing with a black hole. A black hole, we understand the black hole is a warp in the space-time continuum. That's not a violation of laws of nature.
What's a violation, exactly?
A violation of laws of nature would be if I shook this pen three times and it turned into a flower. A violation of the laws of nature would be if suddenly I began floating in the air and flying around the room, and people went up and they, like, you know, were looking for wires and trying to find some means of propulsion, and I had no room for propulsion.
So could you say that a miracle is when you hallucinate drug? Like, if you took a drug and made you hallucinate, is that a miracle because you're seeing stuff in your mind?
No, because that doesn't really happen.
I mean, like, yeah.
That's just
a miracle is something that happens in reality, like a public event that all of us witness. Where you have something happens that goes against the unalterable course of human experience.
So I guess even if you witnessed a miracle, it would only really benefit you, right? Because it's subjective, it seems, since testimony isn't considered, you know. But it goes against, like, then what's the whole point of, like, witnessing anything if in reality nobody else is going to take your word for truth until they witness it themselves?
Like, if something happened right now, and like anyone outside this room wouldn't know what happened, it would just be guessing, like what we said.
Yeah, but there's a difference. Like, I gave the example last time. I was like, what if I told you I had a twin brother? Would you believe me? And you're like, well, I'd probably have to believe you. And like, well, what if I told you I was abducted by aliens? Like, now that's not exactly a miracle. That's something that sort of, I don't know, would that fit Hume's definition of a miracle? Laws of nature, uniform experience. I mean, if Hume might say, well, nobody's ever been abducted by aliens, so therefore, scratch that. But there's, and this hits on the sort of idea of the principle of credulity, which I think is actually what's right about Hume. And this idea that extraordinary planes require extraordinary evidence. So now, it might be that I would to give you convincing evidence that I was abducted by aliens, but I'd have to give you some pretty good proof. If I tell you I have a twin brother, and I just, you know, you look him up on the Facebook, and there he is, and there's a whole bunch of posts, and there's pictures of his niece and his, or my niece and my nephew, and, you know, eventually, you know, you might figure out that if I furnish you with enough evidence, maybe I'd bring him into class and I'd have to do that. But probably I could just, like, show you, like, you know, the fact that he works for the state of California, and a picture of him and his name on some roster, you know, and you think, well, it'd be pretty hard for me to forge government documents, maybe. And eventually, you'd probably believe me without even short of me bringing him here. And that's because people having twins is something that's not a violation of the laws of nature. If I told you last night I was meditating and I was able to levitate like this high off of my prayer rug, then you'd say, you know, that you probably wouldn't. It might be some people that believe, but most people would be skeptical. Why? Because most people have never had experience like that. And Hume would say, nobody's ever had experience like that. Who wasn't on the drug or something. So, now, but what's, are there some criticisms of Hume out here? Well, yes, how does he know this?
Yeah. He's basically just saying what he knows. It doesn't really speak for everybody else.
What is the strength of this claim that we have a uniform experience through the laws of nature and never been violated? Well, because a miracle is a law, but it violates the laws of nature. And we know that those don't occur. Because the laws of nature can never be violated. Because that's what's the way, because nobody's ever seen the laws of nature violated. Why? Because they can't be. Like, can you see how that's circular reasoning? Right? He says a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and the laws of nature have never been violated. But how do you know the laws of nature have never been violated?
Just because you haven't seen it, you mean?
Well, he thinks this is a generalization of all human experience.
Yeah, just because you haven't seen doesn't mean it hasn't happened, I guess. But
yeah, he's not just saying about you, he's talking about all human beings.
Yeah, so how does he know?
Well, you know, what about all the people, the stories in the Bible? Those are like testimony, right, of people that said they did see the laws of nature violated. So so why, when he goes through all of human experience, why does he discount certain experiences? Well, because those are violation of the laws of nature, and we know the laws of nature can never be violated. So this is debating the question or circular reasoning. He's assuming that miracles don't occur, and then using that to prove miracles don't occur. He's already assuming they can't occur. He's assuming this premise, which is questionable, because there's lots of people who report seeing miraculous things. I had a student, I think, in the online section talking about having some feeling of dread and foreboding, and then immediately getting a call from I think her son, who was in a terrible automobile accident. Right? How do you explain that? Well, she says that was a miracle. There's something supernatural going on there. People just don't get feelings and then have impending doom and then have something happen. You know, where the doom actually did occur. Yeah.
Isn't that just kind of sixth sense? Like, I was thinking about a random friend the other day when I was walking the library, and there he was. And I was just, it was really random. You know, just like weird stuff like that happens a lot.
Yeah, I think what Hume would say that if that happens a lot, then it's not really miraculous. But he might also say that how many times were you thinking about your friend or some other person, and they weren't, there? It's and this is this whole idea of another problem is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is when you pay attention to all the times that two things went together, but don't pay any attention to the times that two things didn't go together. So like my mom thinks she has psychic powers. Why? Because when my dad was at work, she'd just be thinking of him and she would do a call. And he'd want to know what's for dinner or what he did tonight, so on and so forth. And right when she was thinking about him, he would call. And she thought that's like I'm sending out these psychic vibes. You know, something supernatural going on. But as it turned out, it was always like between 4 and 5 o'clock. And you know, my dad would usually call about the same time. And so, I mean, and then there were times where my mom would be thinking about my dad when he didn't call. But she didn't pay attention to those times. Right? Because you're just thinking about, she's thinking about, oh, I wonder, you know, what Kent's doing when he's going to be home from work, and then he doesn't call. You know, I was thinking about him, he didn't call. Right? You just totally forget about that. But you're thinking, I wonder what we're going to do for dinner tonight. And the phone rings, you're like, ooh, that's weird. Yeah, you pay attention to that. So, and that's just this idea, our mind's always looking for patterns. This is why you notice. This is like, when we were living in the jungle, and somebody eats some berries, and then he's like, you know, spewing his guts out, and then he dies. And you're like, ooh, I better pay attention to that, right? And this is it's survival of the fittest, right? It's our mind's ability to hook up cause and effect. And this is probably why there's prohibition against eating shellfish in the Old Testament, because shellfish allergy is a pretty common thing. And so they're like, oh, stay away from that. That's that bad. But sometimes you get superstitions that happen, like somebody was stepping a crack in the sidewalk or walked under a ladder and they bumped the ladder and it fell on, something heavy fell on them, or somebody died. Like, oh, walking under ladders is bad luck. Well, maybe it's just not a good idea. Maybe somebody stepped on a crack in the sidewalk and tripped, right? And then there's this idea, well, don't step on the cracks in the sidewalk, you'll trip. Well, just don't trip. So our minds look for these patterns. And that might be part of what's going on with the miracles. But it seems to Hume's argument is too strong. He's begging the question, or circular reasoning. Circular reasoning. Also, this seems to violate his views on cause and effect, which I think you mentioned earlier, that Hume says that we can't prove cause and effect, right? That cause and effect is all in our mind. But here he seems to have a very robust, even absolute view about cause and effect. That cause and effect is real. A miracle is a violation of laws of nature. Remember, when we're talking about Hume says, well, you see the cause, but the effect doesn't follow of necessity. It could turn out to be anything. It's no more probable that the sun will rise tomorrow than it won't. Remember that? So why suddenly, when he gets to those events, does he become an absolutist about cause and effect? So Hume seems to be inconsistent in that way, too. But I do think that there's something going on, this principle of credulity, that in ordinary circumstances, you believe what somebody tells you, unless you think there's some reason not to believe them. But what are the reasons not to believe the person? It's something which is out of the course of ordinary events. A person claims the power of levitation, or to be able to tell your future, or that a dead person came to life, et cetera, et cetera. Something which is out of the course of ordinary experience. Then you need to ask for some extra evidence. You need extra proof. Otherwise, you should be skeptical. So the idea is Carl Sagan's thing, where he says extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
How can you get proof of existence? Existence isn't a miracle.
Why is the world here? It's a miracle.
I guess we have no way to prove that it's never been different. But.
So you're saying that every time you see a sunrise, it's a miracle, or?
I guess just
see a baby born.
Just the fact that everything happens, it could be a miracle, you know?
What do you mean? The world exists? Is a miracle that the world exists instead of not exist, or that there's something rather than nothing?
Anything's here.
Wouldn't it be more of a violation of the laws of nature if the world just suddenly ceased to exist?
Yeah, I guess. But
I feel that would surprise me a little more.
That seems like a funny way of using the term miracle. Sometimes people use a miracle as sort of something that's amazing or something. And people people say a sunrise, or every sunrise is a miracle. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Or every time a baby boy is born, it's a little baby girl, it's a little miracle. Right? But the miracle of life, right? But I'm not sure what that means. Other than it creates warm, fuzzy feelings in people, or it sort of creates certain emotional sensations.
Just the thought that you created the person inside of your body, that's a miracle.
But in your third grade biology class, you see the little, the little squirrely polywog guys trying to get into the egg, and you're like, that seemed miraculous to me. That's what I learned in third grade biology class.
So you look at it sometimes, maybe it's just just kind of bland in your mind, but really it's more special than you think, or something,
things might be special. What do you mean by but they wouldn't be a miracle. Be special.
What about if the law of nature itself is miraculous? It's crazy that this earth is here in this huge universe and everything's working, and everything's working together, and that's crazy.
So that there are laws of nature or something? That there's mathematical simplicity in
the
structure.
Law of nature itself is miraculous.
That there are laws of nature is miraculous. Hume's definition, that would, I don't think that would really work. But if the general sense of a miracle is as the laws of nature, Alicia.
I was thinking about this earlier, and it seems like language is really playing tricks on us here, because I agree with Hume's, I agree that Hume's definition would negate this awe that, say, for example, I feel for life, waking up in the morning, it's a phenomenal world, it's incredible. And so just being filled with awe, at first the conversation started, and I was like, life is a miracle. But then thinking about it linguistically, I think awe is really a better word in my world.
That's a good
sunset.
Word.
It was like, you know, maybe it's not good. We're in awe of it. You know, we're just almost in, you know, so much bigger than us.
So amazing compared to what? Is what I would ask. Like, I mean, it seems like if you say something is amazing or special, it seems like you have to have some notion of something being unamazing and mundane or not special.
To the vacuum
of space. It seems there's nothing more mundane than life.
Maybe less than said compared to the vacuum of space.
Well, maybe the vacuum of space is special compared to there being stuff in the space. Isn't it amazing that there's space with nothing in it?
Right.
Yeah.
If you could change his definition to be more effective, how would you change it?
I'll just say that. I think I'm going to save that for next time. So yeah, maybe think about the depth. What does it really mean to say that something's miraculous or a miracle? I'll have to think about it. If I wanted to patch up being what I would do. All right, Monday we're talking about moral knowledge. And the next Wednesday, political knowledge and review. Don't forget to post the forum Sunday, 11:55 p.m. this week. And also, if you forgot last week, you still can do it tonight if you forgot. I gave you till Wednesday because I got the forum up late. So do last week's by tonight if you haven't done it, and make sure to post by Sunday for this week's.